Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Recently, I went rogue in France. I packed up my recording equipment, and without the company of my usual sound engineers, I took off to make Louisiana Eats radio there. On this week's show, I'm sharing that incredible experience with you all. We begin at Clos Lucet in the Loire River Valley with a personal tour of the last home of Leonardo da Vinci, given by Count Hubert Saint-Brie, whose family has owned the chateau for generations. Then, we're off to take Paris by mouth. That's the name of a company that operates insider food-centric walking tours, taking visitors off the beaten path to places that tourists rarely learn about. Finally, we visit a French marché with Patricia Wilson and Raynette DiCicco. You won't believe the things we saw and tasted there. Parlez-vous français? Don't worry, we're handling the translation on this week's Louisiana Eats. Just after I arrived in Paris, I was whisked away on a fast train to the Loire River Valley, where I had the honor of not only meeting the noble Saint-Brie family, but enjoying their generous hospitality as well at their family home, Chateau Beauchene. In true French fashion, Marie Saint-Brie welcomed us with a toast.
To the friendship of France and America.
Ah. Ah. France
and
America.
Louisiana.
And Louisiana. And Chicago. So let's...
The very next day, Marie's brother, Count Hubert Saint-Brie, took us to the other family chateau, the famous Clos Lucet. This breathtaking manor was built in the 15th century and was originally the home of King Charles VII and his wife, Anne de Bretagne. Clos Lucet was the childhood home of King Francis I and later the final dwelling place of Leonardo da Vinci. Da Vinci spent the last 4 years of his life at Clos Lucet and finished several masterpieces while there, including the Mona Lisa. In 1854, the historic home became the property of the Saint-Brie family, who used it as a country retreat, spending many summers and holidays there. Here with remembrances of his unusual childhood at Clos Lucet is Count Hubert Saint-Brie.
Welcome. Welcome. So this is Le Clos Lucet. Originally, the name is Clos Luce, the Casa di Luce, the House of Light. That's why they call Leonardo da Vinci call it Le Clos Luce, La Maison de la Lumière. This house basically is part of the royal domain, belongs to Charles VIII and Anne de Bretagne. Later came François Ier, François I, who was the king of the Renaissance. The story of Leonardo da Vinci starts with François Ier. François Ier was a beautiful man of 20 years. And François Ier went in Italy there was the war on Italy because the French were supposed to have territories in Italy. So there was this war who lasted years and years. But in fact, the Italians were far more in advance from the French, because they are already the Renaissance of everything in the art and everything. And when François Ier went to Milano, he met Leonardo da Vinci, who was 60. And Leonardo da Vinci, as you know, maybe was moving from one prince to the other. He worked from the Sforza, he worked for the families, Medicis. And when he met Leonardo da Vinci, it was in Milano, and he said, okay, why you don't come to France? Invite him to come. And Leonardo da Vinci said yes. And we must bear in mind, a man of 60 at that period, he was still in great shape, even though he was going to leave his country forever. He knew he won't never come back. But he said yes. And he crossed the Alp, the mountain, on a horseback, and he took the three main paintings, La Joconde, Mona Lisa, Saint Anne, and Saint John the Baptist. Now, he stayed here 4 years, and he was very active. He finished to paint Mona Lisa. He designed many projects for François Ier. He's supposed to be the guy who designed the staircase at Chambord. He organized parties here, big parties. He said he organized such a party that the impression is that the night was the day, with the astre, you know, the moon, and was extremely dynamic, and organized a river that would link all the castles from one to the other. And he designed a castle of the future with the door open automatically. You know, he was very active and very happy to live here. He wrote a lot here. He designed a lot here. We know that maybe he spent the best latest 4 years of his life. He died here. Like the history say, in the arm of François Ier. François Ier managed to come to be there when he died, and he was named the artist of the kingdom. He was the first artist of the kingdom. They had a very strong relationship. François Ier named Leonardo da Vinci my father, and Leonardo da Vinci named him my son. That's a story. So we're going to visit now the house where he lived the 4 years of his life.
Hubert spoke of Leonardo as though he were a personal family friend who perhaps still walks the halls of the exquisite chateau.
We always see Leonardo as an old man with a big beard, but that's not the point. Leonardo da Vinci was a very handsome man, very tall, very strong. He was capable of riding horses, wild horses, taking them and keeping them under his power. He was vegetarian. Very strong with the hand.
He was a vegetarian? Was that very uncommon at that time?
I guess so. Yes, I guess so. Vegetarian. He knew the positive aspect of being vegetarian. He knew why he was vegetarian, I guess. And he wrote thousands of documents we call codex. And it remains a few. There is one which belongs to the Queen, but there is one who belongs to Bill Gates. But I think what remain, a few thousand pages, but it would be only the third of what he designed. But extremely prolific, you know what, all the time. Which we used to say he has a mind of synthesis. He could make the synthesis of what was done before and present it as it's going to be in the future. Do you mind to come, Peter?
Once the visitors were done snapping pictures, we moved on to the living quarters where the Count and his family spent so many happy hours. Hubert had no ordinary childhood, even for a count, and told us all about what it was like to come of age surrounded by Da Vinci's legacy.
So we lived there, and we lived in these beds, you know. And we were very frightened of Leonardo da Vinci, because I thought it was Renard. The fox, Leonardo da Vinci. And, you know, because we live with Leonardo da Vinci, we talk, my mother talked to us like he was still living because she didn't make the difference. I realized that was history, but later on. there was no water. They were the water with tubs, you know. We really lived like a long time ago. We had a very strange life. And when we went to school, you had problems, you know.
How much of the year would you be here?
No, we come for the winter, for Christmas, you know. But it was the life stopped completely because, in fact, it belonged to a generation, two generations over my father, you know. And they didn't change. So when we spent the childhood, the toys were toys from the 19th century. Everything was, you know, nothing, no electricity, nothing. You know? And that's the way we were brought up, you know. That's why we're maybe so strange.
Yes.
We didn't know.
So it's too late to be cured. Too late to be. No chance.
Yes.
When you were children, did you have Christmas mass here?
Yes, we had a small Christmas because my uncle, the brother of my father, was a priest.
And would that have been midnight mass and a reveillon
sometime,
like we do in New Orleans?
Sometime.
Then we moved on to my favorite part of the tour, the dining room and kitchen, where the Count further illustrated for us the surreal and anachronistic nature of growing up in a Renaissance time capsule.
And this
She's expert.
Would have been your family dining room, where you
yes,
all
it's
would...
a, yes, it's a family dining room, la salle de réception for Leonardo when he received his guests, and I guess where the king were coming here, the ambassadors, the people who were coming to visit him.
So when you were a child, yes, and you would be here, there would be a big fire in the fireplace?
Yes, we had a big fire, and we had Christmas there.
Oh.
Yeah, it was wonderful, yes.
What would Christmas dinner be like?
Oh, very simple, you know, mushrooms. vegetables from the garden, and also wild bear, you know.
Wild bear.
Chevreuil. We used to eat, like, in the old time, because we had a very... old, not old, but a French cook, you know.
So your father was a hunter? And
No, my father was not a hunter. No, but we lived from the house at that time, lived from the hands, you know. Yes. It was very simple life, you know, here.
There was really no electricity.
No.
Finally, we ended our tour at the entrance to the chateau's underground tunnel, a passageway that Francis I had constructed so he could visit his beloved Leonardo without being detected by the town folks.
And this is the underground.
Where Francis I could go back and forth?
Yes, the underground to the chateau. So François Ier used to come and visit Leonardo through this underground, who walks under the city until the chateau.
Approximately, yes. The distance is how long?
I guess maybe 2 kilometers.
When you were a child, did
of
you
course.
All play in there?
Yes, we were very scared. We like to be scared.
And
we like
to
scare our friends.
So how far did you go? Could you go all the way?
At that time, 2 kilometers to the castle.
You could go all the way when
yes.
you were a child.
Yes, no, because it starts to be, when they build up the road, they start to. But no, you can go a certain distance. It's very frightening.
Count Hubert Saint-Brie of Chateau du Clos-Lucet. When we come back from a short break, we're taking on Paris by mouth. So don't go anywhere. You don't want to miss this.
Dans la rue qui sent déjà l'hiver. Parmi tous ces inconnus qui rentrent.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's.
Oh, well, my name's Jennifer, and I give food tours for a company called Paris by Mouth. So there are 3-hour-long tours, and we introduce people to different neighborhoods and the great food in the neighborhoods. The bakeries, the chocolatiers or chocolate makers, the spice shops, the charcuterie shops, the wine.
Upon returning to Paris, I joined American Jennifer Greco of Paris by Mouth, who took me on a walking tour of the Marais neighborhood in the City of Lights. Bringing along my trusty sound recorder, I followed Jennifer from shop to shop while she described the delicacies we would discover inside. Jennifer began the tour by taking me down a busy side street with cars and mopeds rushing by us while Parisians went about their daily business. Our first stop was a tiny little ham and charcuterie shop, so small you could walk right past it if you weren't paying attention. The shop is called Caractère de Cochon, a play on words that means pig-headed, in the same sense that we use that expression to describe a particularly stubborn individual.
So this is character de cochon, and I jokingly refer to it as a temple of ham, because when you come in here, you're honestly surrounded by air-cured hams, cooked hams, and then all of these beautiful dried sausages that come from all over Europe. Solo, the owner, has gone all over. He's collected some really interesting things here. Many of them are very rare, very small production, and very difficult to find outside of the region that they're produced in. So he has hams that are from Italy. They're wrapped up in grape must. Grape must is the leftover stems and seeds and skins after the grape pressing. So they hang these hams for a couple of years, and they wrap them with this grape must, and it imparts this lovely fruitiness into the ham. He has another one that is a certain breed of ham called the Noir de Bigorre. And they eat nothing but acorns their entire life. And then they age these hams for about 4 years. So you get this incredible nutty flavor. So if you've only ever had a prosciutto or a serrano type ham, these will blow your mind, because there's different textures, different levels of salt, different flavors, different nuttiness. They're just amazing. And one of the coolest things he has in here is in this little domed glass, under this glass dome here.
It looks like meatballs.
It does look like meatballs. It is a cured sausage meat that is full of little bits of truffle from France and then covered in Parmesan cheese. It's called a snowball. In English, it's not a boule de neige. It's called a snowball. And I've never seen them for sale anywhere else. And they actually come from Austria. And they're really delicious.
Do they need to be cooked?
No. It's a sausage, a cured sausage meat that you would slice like a pepperoni or a salami. So you just slice it thinly and eat it, and it has the really wonderful flavor of truffle, but not too truffly. That's one thing I find with truffle. Things can be too truffly. These back here that look like hockey pucks,
yes,
those are called berets. So the beret is the famous French hat. It actually comes from the Basque country down in the southwest. So those little sausages are sprinkled with a certain pepper called the Piment d'Espelette, which is a special pepper from the Basque country. So this little sausage is traditional to that region, and again, something very unusual that you don't find outside of the region.
As Jennifer pointed out some of her favorites, the shop owner, who goes simply by the name Solo, greeted us and began to give us a tasting tour of his amazing display of meats.
This one has a vein of...
This is a ham with truffle.
Right.
And this is a culatello with truffle. What is the difference?
I don't know.
Between ham and culatello? The ham is a leg.
Okay.
From here to here.
The thigh, we'd say, yeah.
And this is a pump.
Okay.
Culatello in Italian, is a boom boom.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the rear end.
It's the rear end.
Voila. So, that's the difference between when they say it's culatello, it's not ham.
It's not ham. Okay.
Culatello is only from
the
high part.
Right.
Voila.
And so this is
rosemary.
Rosemary, a vein of rosemary. Do you have any of the basil? Oh, this one's sage here.
Non, j'ai pas.
Oh, so like
pine.
Pine tree needles, so it's aged in needles.
And what about all of your terrine?
Ah, the terrine. This is typically French also. You have different type of cheese head, and you can find different type in all over region of France, because they have their specialty with wine. For example, the first one and the real one is from Bourgogne.
The jambon persillé.
Le jambon persillé de Bourgogne. It's cooked with the wine. Sometimes when it's very chic, they use Chablis.
Yes. Nice,
because Bourgogne is Chablis.
Yes.
And sometimes they use Vouvray. Vouvray is another wine, a sparkling wine.
Nice.
Okay. And then you have from Britain, the tongue and the different part, the la joue, comment on dit la joue?
The cheeks, the pork cheeks and the tongue.
And it's cooked with...
aspic and parsley.
Voilà, persil, et aussi du, comment on appelle ça, des petits légumes.
Oh, the little vegetables.
Well, little
like
vegetables.
Baby vegetables.
Voilà.
Voilà.
Yes. Et là, nous avons...
This is a fascinating one. It's
voilà.
Wrapped in hay or straw. Voilà. And then they pour, is it Armagnac or Cognac?
Armagnac
over it, and they light it on fire.
Incredible. Wow, so much tradition.
Voilà. Yes. Là, par exemple, là aussi, c'est très particulier. This is very particular because it's a specialty from Corsica, the south of the island, the famous island in Italy. It's made of all the leaves from the pork. Leaf, on dit?
Leaf?
Leaf.
The fat? The liver?
Liver. The liver. Okay, the liver, le foie.
Okay, the liver.
The liver, and they smoke them.
Oh, wow.
And they add some maigre de porc. Comment on appelle maigre de porc?
Pork fat. Maigre?
Maigre, maigre.
Like fat.
Non, maigre de porc, c'est justement c'est le maigre, c'est un peu de gras mais très peu de beaucoup de viande. It's non fat. You have just kind of meat and sometimes fat. Voilà. And you say maigre.
Okay.
Maigre. It's like bacon, but the other part of the bacon more meat and no more fat.
Okay.
Maigre. Maigre is thin.
So it's not big junk, giant chunks of fat. It's,
voilà.
It's meat with a little bit of fat to add that soft, unctuous texture.
Voilà.
Okay.
You need fat everywhere.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So in your entire shop, what do you think you have today that is the rarest that no one might ever see?
They make 100 par an.
Off. Et encore.
Plus.
Oui, 100, c'est déjà beaucoup, hein?
Oh, okay, so they make between 80 and 100 per year of this one. So it's very difficult to get one.
La truie?
That's the virgin.
The
one
virgin,
is unusual.
This one. And also the beef ham.
Ah.
The beef ham is done yesterday. Yeah, yesterday. Last
Not
year.
Yesterday.
It's like yesterday.
It's
last
months.
Year. And it's a vintage 10 months. And it's from also the la cuisse.
The thigh.
Ah. Voilà.
It's delicious.
C'est très, très bon.
Right. After le brac. Woof. Special, special. Well, I think we just have to buy a lot of it.
Okay.
Aucun Boeing sur mon transit. Aucun bateau sous mon transit. Je cherche en vain la portée exacte. Je cherche en vain.
Bonjour. Donc, on va prendre une baguette, s'il vous plaît. Et, does everyone want a croissant? Trois croissants.
Une baguette et trois croissants?
Oui. Pas trop cuite, s'il vous plaît.
Next up on our tour, Jennifer took us to a bakery located in the center of town, 134 RDT Boulangerie Pâtisserie. We bought some croissants and sat down on a bench overlooking the bustling shop. In between bites of croissant, Jennifer explained the unique story of the baker at 134 RDT.
I wanted to introduce you to this bakery because this is owned by a baker named Benjamin Turquier. And he's really unusual because he didn't start his career as a baker. He started as an auditor in finance and about 8 years ago decided to completely change his life and start baking bread. And since he did that, he's done incredibly well for himself. There's a competition called the Best Baguette of Paris that's held every year. It's held at the end of March, and he's placed 3 times in the top 10 of this competition since he started baking bread. So that's a really, really big deal. The first prize winner of this competition, they get about 4,000 euros as prize money, but it's the recognition that they get, and their business goes up. And they also get to provide baguettes to the president at the Élysée Palace for the entire year that they're number one.
That's fantastic.
I know,
so
it is.
What do you think makes his baguette so top and number one?
He is very passionate about what he does. It's all hands-on. It's a special baguette called the baguette de tradition, like tradition. So it's an older style. It only has 4 ingredients in it. It's a protected item, food item. It's just flour, water, yeast, and salt. It's all hand-done. The baguettes are risen in cloth-lined baskets. So it is it's a labor of love, I'd say.
Well, can we taste that labor of love?
Of course, of course.
The crispy croissant shattered easily, showering me with its buttery crumbs. it was easy to see why the baker has received so many accolades.
So the other unusual thing about Benjamin, in addition to making award-winning bread and croissants, is he is an award-winning triathlete as well. And they deliver bread to several restaurants here in the neighborhood, and it's really, really cute because when he is training, he'll bring his bicycle to the bakery, and he'll strap on a backpack full of baguettes and go off and train and make deliveries at the same time. So he really is, I call him a Renaissance man. I've seen him in the back up on a ladder with his head in the ceiling fixing the electrics. I think he can do absolutely anything.
That's fantastic. Well, sitting here on this bench with you, Jennifer, I'm really curious what the very best croissant in Paris might sound like. It's really hard for everybody to get a taste, but maybe they could get a crackly sound.
Bonjour, je m'appelle Jean-Luc, vous êtes dans la maison Tiercelin, très vieille maison familiale, c'est la septième génération.
We continued our walking tour to the Upper Marais so we could visit an ancient spice shop. Upon entering the building, the scent of saffron lay heavy in the air, and we were greeted by shop owner Jean-Luc, who explained the history of his family's business.
Très basique, classique, la coriandre, le thym. Ou bien après, nous avons un superbe mélange.
For the sake of listeners who don't speak French, I turned back to Jennifer for translation.
Okay, we are in the Maison Tiercelin. This is a seventh generation spice merchant. They started with a saffron farm in the south of France in 1809, and it's grown into this little empire of spices, spice blends that they have made themselves. They still are famous for their saffron. They do beautiful mixes of salt with truffles and spices and some with rose petals or chili peppers. They're really well known for their vast array of peppercorns. They have peppercorns from Nepal, from China, from India, from Madagascar, different flavors and for different uses. You're supposed to use some on meats and pork, some on fish. They also have honeys, vinegars, oils, and really wonderful syrups. They've developed several different flavors of syrups for different cocktail bars here in the neighborhood. So you can get saffron syrup and elderflower syrup and Szechuan peppercorn syrup. So really unusual things. And this is one of the most fun parts of the shop. They call this their spice sniffing bar or bar à sniffer. So they have all this vast array of spices here. You can smell them and get an idea of what they would be like before you actually buy.
Let's examine some of these things. Where would we start?
Well, we're going to start with something a little sweet. This is called a tonka bean. And the tonka bean is a wild almond from South America. It's actually illegal in America, in the United States. It is. They say that it has trace amounts of coumarin, which is where we get the drug name Coumadin. Mm-hmm. So trace amounts of a blood thinner. I mean, so trace you'd have to eat kilos of it to be sick or to have your blood thinned. But the FDA banned it. So you can't get this in the States anymore. But it's used in desserts. It has a really interesting aroma, kind of a combination of cherries, almonds, cinnamon, vanilla. And you grate it, because they're big black almonds, and you grate it like you would with a nutmeg and infuse milk or cream and make ice creams or creme brulees, things like that.
That really was lovely. A very lovely, rich, sweet, deep scent, really yes. Unlike anything I've ever smelled before. Okay. And what else?
Okay, a couple different things that come from Nepal. And this is one of the most unusual things I've ever encountered. It's called a Timut peppercorn. So it's a peppercorn that you'd crush in a mortar and pestle like you would with a Szechuan peppercorn, but it has this amazing citrusy, grapefruity type aroma.
Yes.
Very light, beautiful on simple grilled fish, grilled chicken, but very unusual. And I've looked for it in other spice shops. I've never been able to find it anywhere else.
Incredible.
And they sell out of it very quickly. So when you see it, it's always good to buy. One of the great blends that he does is called The Secret of Pasta, or Segreto de la Pasta. This is their own blend, and it's very meaty.
Mm.
So yeah. I know a lot of vegetarians buy this because they like the fact that it's almost like you're adding meat to your red sauce, but you're not. It's a beautiful mix of cumin. I think there's some turmeric in it, some oregano. It's very different. And then he does the wonderful vinegars back here, saffron vinegar and fig vinegar. You have lime, you have hibiscus, which is what I'm currently completely addicted to. What else? Honey vinegar, rose vinegar. And then you have the oils, truffle oils, both black truffles or white truffles from Italy. There's almond oil and grilled almond oil. So really vast array of flavors. And then these are really unusual, these salt mills. This one is for fish. So you've got some blue salt from Persia. You've got some different like coriander and different ingredients in it. Onion and cumin and piment, like a spicy pepper, like a cayenne almost. This one, the pink one. So this is pink salt, pink peppercorns, rose petals, and what else is in here? Black peppercorn, but really, really nice. You finish dishes with these. You don't actually cook with them. You add them at the very end. Also, different kinds of quinoa. So white quinoa, red quinoa, black quinoa. Quinoa souffle, you would eat it like popcorn, so you would just nibble on it. And then just around the corner here, they have all their sugars. So you've got violet sugar, lavender sugar, rose sugar, bergamot orange sugar. They have little candied, crystallized mimosa flowers for your decorations, and candied mint and rose petals. So some really unusual things. Oh, and the saffron, too. So they do everything with saffron. They make saffron caramels, saffron vinegar, saffron mustards, because that's still what they're very famous for.
That's fantastic. And for seven generations.
Yes. And Jean-Luc has some saffron here he wants you to be able to smell.
Ooh, the real thing.
Yes.
Beautiful. After a busy afternoon touring a variety of shops in the Marais, the shadows began to stretch out into the street, and the tour began winding down. Jennifer, now, of course, that we've had the bread, we've had the ham, we've spiced it up, now, of course, we're going to end with the sweets on this wonderful, delicious walk through Paris. So where are we, and why is this place so special?
We are at Jacques Chenin Chocolaterie. Jacques is considered one of the best chocolate makers in Paris. He comes from a background that has no formal training. He really is a self-made man. This building dates back to the 17th century, and he's created this beautiful space where you can come and you can buy his chocolates, his pâte de fruits, which are little fruit jellies. They're very unusual because they're not gummy and sticky like many people think they are. They're made with 80% fresh fruit or vegetable, because he does some unusual flavors like beet and fennel and zucchini, but then he'll do more classic flavors like strawberry and raspberry and mango and passion fruit. And then he also has become quite famous for his caramels. I like to refer to them as butter bombs because they are so buttery, technically very, very difficult to make, to have them hold together, and they just melt in your mouth. They're not sticky and chewy like a caramel that we're all used to. These are something very special.
Yeah, we tried one and it doesn't stick to your teeth.
No.
It kind of melts in your mouth. Yeah. And amazing range of flavors.
Yes.
He has fruit flavored caramels.
Yes, he has a mango passion fruit one, which has become one of his signature flavors, really. A lot of people buy those. They're very fresh and very light and really refreshing. Then he has the very classic flavors made with the salt butter. So just a plain caramel. Then he does walnuts from the Périgord, from the southwest of France. He does hazelnut and almond and vanilla. And then a couple other fruits that he does are blackcurrant or cassis and raspberry. So very refreshing.
Let's walk over to the chocolate case because the view is so stunning. Each piece of chocolate really looks like a little piece of artwork.
Yes.
That's something we don't see much in the United States of this caliber.
Yes. Everything is made here upstairs. There's this beautiful circular staircase in the middle of the shop. And there's about 18 people working up there. And he makes some unusual flavors. This one here, for instance, is dark chocolate with tarragon. This one is wonderful if you like chocolate and mint together because it's not peppermint, it's actual fresh spearmint. And someone once described it to me as tasting like a chocolate mojito.
Oh.
Because you really taste the essence of the mint. He also does basil. He does a Szechuan peppercorn, a chestnut honey, vanilla. The coffee one is incredible. It's just bordering on bitter, but just wonderful mix of coffee and dark, dark chocolate. And then some of his milk chocolate ones, he has this one that is toasted hazelnuts, toasted almonds, and lime zest. Very, very refreshing, but yet buttery at the same time. And if he does use any fresh herbs, he grows them here on the roof as well.
Oh.
And if he uses the spices, like the Szechuan peppercorn or the honey and the chestnut honey, he buys them at the spice shop that we were just at.
Well,
so very much in the neighborhood.
I spotted that one that is... The Tonka.
Oh, the Tonka bean.
The Tonka tech.
Yes.
Yes, with the Fev de Tonka.
Yes.
And that is the most unusual taste.
Yep.
The scent of it was fascinating. And to me, it reminds me of the inside of a peach pit, sort of sour and sweet and fruity and all of that together. Really delicious. When you come here, how do you choose, Jennifer?
It's hard. I try to get a mix of flavors so people can get an idea of what he does with the herbs and something with the nuts, and then usually a more classic like a coffee or just a plain ganache with dark chocolate. He never uses too much sugar, so nothing here is overly sweet, but very, very intense. They're not very big, but if you have a couple, you're satisfied. You don't need a giant bar of chocolate here to get your chocolate fix, I guess.
Well, we're going to put all the addresses of the amazing places we visited on the Louisiana Eats website. But if someone who's planning a trip to Paris and would like to have a similar experience to this, would like to get in touch with you all, what's the website they should visit?
It's parisbymouth.com. And we have a great website that helps people navigate the food scene in Paris because it changes every day. So we're a group of food writers and food experts. And so we're constantly looking at the food scene. And then we have tours in several different neighborhoods.
Even if you're just dreaming of coming to Paris, you could have fun visiting it online.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, thank you, Jennifer. Thanks so much for spending the day with us.
It was a pleasure.
And I know that New Orleans is sometimes your home away from home. So come visit us.
I will. I come every year. So I love New Orleans like my second home.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Thank you, Poppy. It was a pleasure.
That's tour guide extraordinaire Jennifer Greco. To stay au courant with all things food related in Paris, visit parisbymouth.com. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats.
How you gonna keep them down on the farm after they seem hairy? How you gonna keep them away from Broadway, jabbing around and painting the town?
What is foie gras, and how is it made? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back.
Imagine Reuben when he meets his pa. He'll kiss his cheek and holler, ooh la la.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets.
listeners, this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What is foie gras, and how is it made? Foie gras is the fattened liver of ducks and geese that has long been a traditional French luxury food. Much controversy surrounds foie gras production because the animals are force-fed to achieve that prized fat liver. The practice of force-feeding animals has been carried out perhaps since the Egyptians began the practice as early as 2500 BC. The Toulouse area of France has long been the center of foie gras production. French women would hold the goose between their knees as they lovingly stroked the alcohol-laden food down their long necks. Not all production in France today is that humane, but in the U.S., foie gras manufacturers such as Hudson River Valley produce foie gras from happy free-range ducks and geese. Their production methods are so humane that they were able to have the California foie gras ban overturned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and this is Louisiana Eats. On my last day in Paris, I had the great fortune to visit a real Parisian marché. Held under the metro near the end of the line, this bustling marketplace appears magically every Wednesday and Sunday and is the favorite marché of American expats, Patricia Wilson and Raynette DeChico.
346, s'il vous plaît, madame. Pour la photo, plus que ça.
For the radio.
On a sunny Sunday afternoon, I joined Patricia and Raynette for a personal tour of some of their favorite vendors in the marché.
All of that basil, those beautiful lettuces.
All the lettuces are gorgeous here, aren't they?
We sampled fruit, vegetables, meats, and delicious breads, all the while taking in the sights, sounds, and smells of a typical Parisian market day.
Okay. Bonjour, madame. Bonjour. La production Bordeaux. Ça, c'est le foie gras de canard. C'est naturel. Il n'y a pas d'alcool dedans. Naturel.
It's all natural, no alcohol.
Dark liver.
Not good. Oh, my goodness.
It's so good.
On est éleveur, producteur.
You should take some.
I'm going to.
After we'd completed our stroll up and down the marché, Patricia, Raynette, and I went to Raynette's apartment, complete with an incredible view of the Eiffel Tower, for a little rosé and conversation. There, they passionately expressed how important Paris has been in their lives and the role the market has played in their friendship.
My name is Raynette DeChico, and I'm actually from Connecticut. I own a travel agency in Puerto Rico, but my heart is in Paris, and this is home.
I'm Patricia Wilson. I'm from a lot of places. I've moved here from South Beach, Miami, where I was teaching at Johnson & Wales University. I'm now retired. I'm from Puerto Rico, of Canadian descent, and I'm here in Paris.
So you brought me today mm-hmm. to that beautiful marché. Mm-hmm. This is a bit of a tradition with you and Raynette.
Yes.
You meet on Sundays. Tell me what a Sunday is like.
Our tradition, I guess we'd say, I never looked at it as a tradition, but I'd come up, do the market, buy a few things, look around, even shoes. I bought some shoes today, some walking shoes, maybe a scarf, maybe some flowers, take pictures, send them back to my students.
The daily marché is probably the most incredible thing you can do in Paris. It is every kind of fish, meat, clothing, cheeses, you name it. It's in the marché. And the advantage of being in the marché is that it is fresh. It is that day fresh. They go out to the outskirts of Paris and buy it at 4 o'clock every morning. The marchés are set up about 7:30. They finish at 1:30 or 2. That's it. They are closed. And the city cleans it up in about 1 hour. You would never even know it was there.
If everything gets so cleaned up and everything is so beautiful, what happens at the end of the market?
First of all, they sell almost everything. They pretty much know how much they need. There is very little waste. Only the overripe things will be kind of put on the side, and people, some of the indigent people, can pick it up. That's fine. But it is not thrown away.
Well, as we walk through the market, that was one of the things that was abundantly clear to me. Nothing was wasted. I've never seen fish heads for sale. I've never seen some of the animal pieces parts that were there in the cases for sale. The French don't waste a thing, do they?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And they all have traditional things that they make with them. So depending on the season, you should see it in the fall and winter when the venison comes in and the pheasants and, oh, all the ducks, the wild ducks. It is amazing.
Lynette, as we walk through the market, the scents, the sounds.
Oh,
the way that the vendors call out to the customers.
Certain ones always tell the same story. Like the Eggman goes, cock-a-doodle-doo. I went, the first time I heard it, I went, what's that? That's the Eggman.
Tell me a little bit about how it is to live in Paris as an American.
As long as you say please and thank you, you are welcome. The French are so happy to have you be part of their neighborhood. And don't think of them as being nasty French. That is a total untruth. They are very, very hospitable. I'm so glad you got to see a real market and a big one.
I will be grateful forever. Trust me, I'll be toasting you in New Orleans as I have a little bit of my lovely tinned foie gras and remembering my time in Paris.
A bottle of rosé wine.
Well, I want to thank you so much for your generosity of time and sharing your Paris with me. Thank you.
Well, I'm glad that you're here, and I hope you come back a lot more.
Oh, well, it's great. And happy New Orleans.
Raynette DiCicco and Patricia Wilson, living embodiments of joie de vivre. It was hard to tear myself away from my Parisian dream vacation. Raynette and Patricia told me to save my nickels and plan a longer visit soon. In fact, they suggested 6 months in Paris could hardly be long enough. But luckily, I live in Louisiana, where it's easy to catch a little taste of Paris anytime the mood strikes. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. This month's Louisiana Eats and Cooks Club is going to be fun, funky, and fabulous with Jill Benson, author of the new book by the same name. We'll get the party started at 6:30 on Thursday, September 24th at the Rouse's Culinary Innovation Center at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Jill and I will be cooking up some delicious dishes from the book, and Brady's Wine Warehouse will provide the wine and the wine education. You'll find the link for tickets on the Southern Food and Beverage Museum's website at southernfood.org and on our Louisiana Eats website at itsneworleans.com. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Tune in next week when we journey to Napa Valley to experience firsthand the grape harvest in the vineyards of Cake Bread Cellars.
We did give you orange gloves, so if there is an accident,
you'll see the blood come through the glove.
No, but if the finger does get detached, it's much easier to see with an orange glove on.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and by Dickie Brennan Steakhouse, a local New Orleans steakhouse serving prime beef in New Orleans French Quarter. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Sean Johnson. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker,
Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.